Jim?
Thank you, Jean, and thank you everyone for joining us today for the fourth and final webinar in the Contaminated Sediment Series. Welcome back to everyone who's joined us for the previous series webinars, and welcome to any new participants we have today. We got a great lineup of speakers, and I'll introduce them in just a few minutes. But first, I would like to introduce the reason for today's session and tell you a few things about these sessions. So this series of webinars was developed by EPA's Office of Research and Development to exchange information on the key challenges we face with contaminated sediment sites. For those of you who aren't familiar, ORD is EPA's scientific research arm, and they help inform agency decisions through their research. Now, the research conducted by ORD and its partners is driven by the needs of its stakeholders. So the objective of the seminars is both to inform you, the practitioners and the stakeholders, about the latest tools and methodologies available, but also to solicit your concerns and understand your research needs around these subject areas. The webinars are designed to be interactive and generate discussion just like you would at a technical conference. And Jean's explained a few ways that you can do that. As we've done in the previous seminars, we've developed a series of interactive activities to get your input throughout the presentations. So to get you warmed up for the idea of online interaction, I've posed a question for your responses. If you're logged on, you'll see a question like this at the bottom of your screen. As Jean mentioned earlier, just respond to the question with a typed in answer or click on the green button if you agree with someone's existing response. We have quite a few respondents. That's great. Thank you, everyone, for responding. Give you a minute here. So you can see from the responses that we have a lot of different ways that folks monitor the contaminated sediments. And we also know that there's a lot of challenges working with contaminated sediments, both in the characterization as well as the remediation and the monitoring phases. Some of these challenges are because we have very large sites. Sediment sites tend to be large and diffuse with multiple sources. They're typically difficult to control with dynamic conditions, and they often have higher remediation costs. And one of the unique things about these sites is there are resources that are contained in the sediment and the surface water ecosystem that we have to be very careful of as we design and characterize these systems. So what do we do about this? Given these challenges, we need to find really effective ways to address the sites all throughout the project life cycle, that is from characterization through long-term monitoring. Our CSMs have to be based on really good characterization data, and we need to apply current and relevant data to inform risk assessments and to clean up these sites and to monitor them over the long term. So over the past several weeks, we've had a series of talks that bring together experts to explore the latest thinking in these areas. So your job today, during this session, is to listen and digest and respond to all the information that's presented and give us your feedback. Today's topic is focused on long-term monitoring of these sediment sites, especially focusing on the performance monitoring at contaminated sediment sites. The speakers that we have will address the concepts as well as very practical applications of long-term monitoring tools and the techniques. So our first presentation is from John Kern, who will introduce us to the concept of surface weighted average concentrations. And John will describe how they're used in long-term performance monitoring. Now, John's the owner of Kern Statistical Services, and he provides statistical services for remedial project managers and other environmental professionals in all media. Our next two speakers will discuss the use of pore water remedial goals or guidance for sediment contaminated sites. Rob Burgess from EPA's ORD will give us an overview of the theory behind passive samplers and discuss the practical aspects of how they can be used for long-term monitoring to evaluate pore water remedial goals or PWRGs. Dr. Burgess works at ORD's Narragansett, Rhode Island lab, and he studies the partitioning and bioavailability of organic and metal contaminants in the environment. He specializes in the use of passive samplers and bioavailability, especially for emerging contaminants. Our next speaker, Lawrence Burkhardt, is also from EPA's ORD, and he'll continue the discussion of PWRGs with a discussion on toxicity testing, or tox testing, and how it can be used in long-term monitoring program. Dr. Burkhardt studies the bioconcentration and bioaccumulation of organic contaminants in benthic invertebrates and fish, as well as supporting the development of remedial goals based on the concentrations of the contaminants in sediment pore water. Our final speaker this afternoon will be Mark Mills, who will discuss how chemical, physical, and biological lines of evidence can be used to evaluate remedy effectiveness, with some examples from some Superfund sites around the country. Dr. Mills' research focuses on remediation and treatment of contaminants in sediment, surface water, wastewater, and soils. His current projects in research are focused on assessing remedy effectiveness of contaminated sediments and the treatment of emerging contaminants, such as PFAS and pharmaceuticals. So, we encourage you to actively participate in these discussions by responding to the various poll activities and submitting your questions for us to pose to the panel at the end of the session. Now, I'd like to turn the presentation over to our first speaker, John Kern of Kern Statistics. Are you there, John?
Yep, I'm here.
Great. It's all yours.
Okay. I'm waiting on my slides to load here. 1 second.
All right. I see them.
There we go. Okay. So, yeah, I want to thank folks for coming around to listen to our presentations today. And I'm going to talk a little bit about surface weighted average concentrations, which are kind of an item that has sort of gained a life of its own within the sediment remediation community and at particularly large Superfund sites. So I'm going to a little bit of an overview. I'm going to talk about a definition of SWAC, a surface weighted average concentration. I'm going to talk a little bit about the kind of the rationale and why we spatial weight and where these things came from. And for starters, if interested in knowing whether people are familiar, unfamiliar with this topic or not, and if they're using them at their sites. So if you want to vote, that would be good, and I'll keep talking while you guys vote. So I'm going to talk a little bit about the application of SWAC in developing remedial action limits, which is not really monitoring, but that's more of a traditional way that these things are used and the way they evolved. Talk a little bit about uncertainty. And then I'm going to switch over and talk about how to use SWACs for monitoring in a way that makes sense. And a lot of that's going to focus on proper sampling, use of probability-based sampling schemes, and then wrap it up with some recommendations. It looks like we've got a bit of a split there of people who know these methods or have heard of them. So what's the definition of a SWAC? It's a weighted average of sample data. It's used for estimating the mean concentration in contaminated sediment over a specified spatial area, and typically over a surficial layer, which might be defined as the top 2 inches or the top 6 inches or what have you. Those things are usually defined at kind of a site-specific basis. They're often used as a surrogate or explicitly as an exposure point concentration in risk assessment. When they are, then you need to have confidence limits to go with those, because we know that an EPC is a 95% confidence interval for the true mean. So if you're using a weighted average, it doesn't sort of change the fact that you still need that confidence limit. Why do we do the weighting? Well, the real sort of approach in most cases is to account for the fact that RIFS data are usually not unbiased. They're usually a combination of investigative data. They have certain types of biases that are often unknown, and so the spatial weighting is intended to sort of fix that problem. But then that brings up the question of how to do the weighting. So you might weight based proportional to, say, a polygon of influence. You might weight by first constructing an interpolated map of the samples and then weight and then averaging the map itself. But then that brings up a whole other suite of questions. How should you make the map? Well, you could use natural neighbor interpolation, kriging, inverse distance, a whole host of things. Other things that are a little less common would be things like spatial stratification. You might stratify based on shoals and navigation channels, things like that. If the sampling is right, the weighting might be equal. You might do equally weighted averages. And then finally, if things are very complicated and you're interested in sort of complex RIFS calculations in terms of remedy selection, you might advance into a geostatistical simulation type procedure. So there's a lot of options, and there are a lot of things to essentially argue about. And sometimes SWAC analyses lead to protracted arguments at sites. And so part of what I want to talk about here is just kind of ways that you might streamline the use of these things and kind of standardize how that goes at a site. So what do I mean by kind of data evolution? I've got an example here. This happens to be at the Kalamazoo River, one of the operable units there. And you can see in plan view, there's an outline of the floodplain. It used to be an impounded sediment area. The dots you can see are sampling locations, and back in 93-94, there was about 30-40 locations sampled, found some contaminants, PCBs, then in 2001, another set of samples drawn for some other reason. You can see there's some focus to those locations. 2003, some more samples, and here you can see there's kind of a focus on the edges of the river, seems like. And then in 2008, some more sampling, some sort of infill was conducted. The question then becomes, how do you develop some sort of an unbiased estimate of the overall average from this sort of mixture of data collected over a variety of different locations and objectives and so forth? So what people have done is spatial weighting. How well does that work? Well, this is kind of an open question. At the end of the day, what people are typically looking for is some sort of a graphic like this that relates, say, a remedial action limit on the horizontal axis versus a post-remedial SWAC on the vertical. Notice I've got a big gray bar at the top. That would represent pre-remedial clean air condition. And then the curve itself would represent the relationship between the SWAC and the remedial action limit. The lower the limit, the lower the SWAC. And then also notice that the error bars get narrower. The more you remediate, the less uncertainty there is. So you get some benefit from remediation. But there's a lot of question about how to develop these confidence limits. We could do a workshop about just that. So today I'm just going to kind of walk through these tip of the iceberg type ideas and the things that people are trying to do with these things. And I notice, are people developing uncertainty bounds for SWAC? Almost nobody. 80% say no. That's interesting and should be something that we need to be thinking about in our sediment work. Seems like an open question. So what about the weighting? Does it matter? I would recommend kind of going close to full screen here when you look at these two maps. What I have on the left is a natural neighbor interpolation, and on the right I have a Thiessen polygon interpolation. Exact same data, same samples. And then the red contour is a threshold value off of the natural neighbor, and then I've just overlaid that over here on the Thiessen polygons. You notice that the Thiessen polygon map looks considerably different than the natural neighbor map. A couple things that are interesting. If you were to calculate the SWAC, it would just be average the mapped values for the Thiessen polygon, or for natural neighbor, you get about 21 milligrams per kilogram. For the Thiessen polygons, about 22. Sounds good, almost the same number. Relative to the kinds of uncertainties we typically see, a 21 and a 22 part per million PCB number off of 100 samples is probably within the interval. But what you notice is the areas are considerably different. So on the left-hand side, the remedial area, if we're gunning for something above 10, again, it's just kind of hypothetical numbers. You have about 34 acres. On the right, about 29 acres. 5 acres of difference is not a small amount when you boil that into cost and all of your remedial and RIFS calculations. So how you do the smoothing and how you develop the SWAC can matter. This is one of the reasons to be thinking about uncertainty bars. Are these things outside the uncertainty bands, or are they within margins of error and you really just need more data to pull the two together? Those are sort of interesting questions for people to be thinking about at sites. I wanted to just show a little bit of a cartoon here that kind of illustrates how the uncertainty can work. And maybe my cartoon is not going to work. Can you help me out here, Gene?
Absolutely. So that cartoon is going to be coming up here on the screen. There we go. And so we should be playing and seeing those bars moving now.
I think I have a slower internet connection than others. So I'll just assume that people can see what's happening there. So what I'm showing in the lower left is a series of maps, all of which were simulated and are consistent with the sample data representing the two top maps that are shown as interpolations. And the bars on the right are essentially rates at which we are capturing the greater than 10 ppm level. And you can see they bounce around from one map to the next. There's uncertainty in the maps themselves. That influences how the SWAC is calculated, and then the uncertainty in your forecast of a SWAC versus a RAL computation. So this is into kind of the more complex part of this type of an analysis where you would need to use a geostatistical simulation in order to understand the uncertainty in the SWAC versus RAL relationship. And we're doing that at some of the bigger, more complex sites. And again, we could do a whole workshop on how to generate that series of maps and so forth. So I will just kind of keep chugging. So there we go. Thank you, Gene. So plugging along. So just recap. This was sort of the traditional SWAC usage. It's been developed as a remedial investigation tool, as an FS tool, as a way to develop remedial action limits as a function of maps, and then to incorporate the uncertainty in those maps. But we're talking about monitoring. So what can we do? We sort of established that the biased data lead to a suite of methods that may vary, and then a set of uncertainties that are tough to quantify, really. And that's kind of the point of these first slides. When you start with biased data, you make things kind of difficult for yourself. One way to get around that is to work on the sampling program itself. As sort of one last bit of emphasis on this. So if we were monitoring, what I'm showing here in this particular slide is a set of unbiased data, which are shown in two circles, and then a series of RI data, which are shown as not the circled groups. And then I've got best fit lines to the two. One, if we fit and include the unbiased and the biased data together, we get about a 4% rate of recovery on sediment. If we only look at the biased set, we get about an 8% recovery rate. The values in the red boxes at the far right would be post-remedial data. Your conclusions would be very different depending on if you use the unbiased or the biased data. With the unbiased data included at a 4% rate, it appears as though the post-remedial data is considerably lower than what that black dotted line would have said had we not done the remedy. With only the biased data, you would kind of conclude, hey, it looks like cleaning up probably didn't do much. I'm right on the trend line. So the issue of how to handle the RI data and how to compensate for biases in the sampling program is really important in terms of the outcomes. The difference between a 4% recovery rate and an 8% recovery rate can mean a huge difference in how you interpret the success of the remedy. I'm leading up to the idea that we need unbiased data. So how do you do that? What kind of unbiased data can we get that's useful? Well, one thing would be just a systematic design. So I've got an example here, just lay out a systematic grid. And if we do that, there's no need to spatially weight. Everything's equally weighted because I've used an equally spaced design. We can use regular old pro-UCL methods to get confidence limits. Comparisons to future data based on the same design are simple. You can pair them up and just do simple pairwise comparisons, or you can fit a regression line to multiple sets. Unbiased sampling is a good idea. The question is, can you combine this with your RIFS data and still get the investigation and spatial resolution that you want? One way to do that is through stratification. So I'm going to show a little bit here. If you kind of slice the site up in terms of areas to be likely to be remediated versus not, which might be, say, shoals versus nav channels or administrative locations that you know to be source areas. You can stratify and then use unbiased sampling within stratum. And then the estimation procedure is still relatively simple. It's just weighted averages of means. So mean averages of averages, essentially. So that's another way to kind of deal with complexity at the site, but still have unbiased estimates of your SWAC at the end of the day. So notice the SWAC is turning into kind of a generic thing. It's really the mean over a defined area. If the sampling design is right, you can get unbiased estimates without a need to kind of make up the weighting scheme as you go. Here's another type of stratification. You might work with actual geomorphic areas. So this is an example where we did some geomorphic mapping, looking at old thalwegs and terraces and so forth, dividing the site up in that way, stratify, and again, simple area-weighted averages of within stratum averages. And there are standard variance formulas and fitting regression lines to those unbiased estimates is straightforward. No need for any kind of spatial tricky weighting. I lost my connection. So for folks, I'm gonna switch computers. It looks like I've lost my internet connection here. Yeah, okay. Oh, I guess I can. So this last one is sort of a very complicated weighting scheme that we conducted. This happens to be at the Portland Harbor, where we stratified based on shoals and nav channels and then identified a series of small boxes. And those boxes can actually be arbitrary as long as we know the sizes of them. And the sampling design is to essentially throw one random dart per box. And then at the end of the day, the weighting scheme is also known. We can use standard formulas. You might use a balanced bootstrap for weighted data, that sort of thing. Again, the point is if we are to incorporate essentially known probability-based design principles in the RIFS process, then we can smoothly move through the RIFS and into the post-remedial monitoring period and have comparable data across those time steps. And what I'm typically recommending is essentially have a portion of your RIFS data to be in some sort of a probability-based sampling scheme, and then augment it with infill in areas that you really want to investigate carefully and delineate fine-scale remedial areas, but don't combine those data for the trend and monitoring parts of the analysis. So recommendations, portion of samples should be based on the probability-based design. SWAC estimation should be based primarily on those unbiased data for monitoring, for RIFS calculations to figure out remedial action limits and so forth. All data need to be kind of in that calculation. Didn't really talk about this, but you could then ask questions about should I reoccupy sites. In theory, we should reoccupy locations for trend estimates. In practice, sediment is typically heterogeneous enough that there isn't that big of an advantage to it. So I think you can really, either direction can work fine. The main thing is unbiased programs at each time step. If sites are complex, you can use stratification to handle that. One thing that's interesting is as long as the sampling program and corresponding estimator are unbiased, you can compare means from different sampling designs. So in one series, you may have done a systematic design. Later, you might decide to stratify the means generated from those, as long as their unbiased estimation procedures are still comparable. So that's a flexibility that people, I think, sometimes assume we don't have. Again, sediment trend estimation and monitoring is really a prospective game, so we should be planning ahead and starting early is good. Again, use that unbiased data as part of the RIFS exploration. And then finally, just want to point out that temporal comparisons based on biased programs are really unreliable, as sort of I was illustrating in that time trend figure, where if we're combining different biased programs with no way to really understand the bias between sampling designs. You were conflating the two questions, time trend versus sampling design differences. So that's all I have, and open for questions.
Well, thanks, John. We do have a couple of questions that have come in. You had mentioned you did a discussion of the uncertainties. And one of our participants was asking, are the uncertainties determined with a sensitivity analysis or through some other statistical means?
Yeah, so if we're using, let's just say we're in the RIFS stage where we are potentially trying to fight the fight with biased data. If we use a weighted average to calculate that SWAC, so maybe you weight by teeth and polygons, then there are variance formulas that specifically use those weights in the variance calculation. And actually, if you do Wikipedia for weighted means, you'll actually find some of the right equations to run there. And people can contact me. I can provide links to that sort of information as well.
Okay, great. So we had a discussion in a recent webinar series about the use of incremental sampling for sediment sites. Could you comment on the use of incremental sampling and how that might fit into this program that you've discussed?
Yeah, for sure. So you might have noticed my systematic layout really is an incremental sample. It's just a matter of whether, I'll call it an incremental sample. It's a matter of whether you take that sediment and throw it in the bucket and run one analysis, or whether you run individual samples separately. So generally speaking, the incremental sample would be, you know, fully applicable. The one thing I would caution in my experience is that the sample handling steps for sediment may start to negate the benefits of the incremental sample. In other words, as you attempt to mix larger volumes of sediment, I think that problem is tougher to deal with than it is in a typical soil site where it's just a little easier to handle material. And so it's useful to think about and potentially test whether or not you really are getting the benefit of, say, mixing 30 samples in a bucket versus actually analyzing them maybe in groups of three or individually. But we are using, you know, kind of small composites fairly commonly in monitoring. So where you basically park the boat and maybe pull three samples per spot, that kind of thing.
I see. Okay. And you had also mentioned that you had recommended that some of the RI data be collected as part of an unbiased sampling program. Now, typically when we set up an RI program, the site team gets together and there's geologists and engineers and risk assessors. Who would be the best resource for helping to understand the statistics required for generating this unbiased sampling program at the RI stage?
That's kind of a self-serving question, Jim. But yeah, some statistical input is good. And I think the principle would be if you're at a site where it's pretty clear that it's not just going to be a quick investigation and kind of confirm that there's no problem. If it's pretty obvious that you're heading towards a fairly lengthy RIFS process, then, you know, kind of splitting out part of your resources and using those in the unbiased part is pretty straightforward, and really any modest amount of your, you know, proportion of your sampling program is better than none. Is what I would say. But you could boil down and do some power calculations and say, I want, you know, X number of samples in order to detect, say, a 10% recovery rate or something like that. So you could do those calculations.
Okay. All right, and one final question. Have you come across developing SWACs across different habitats?
Yeah, so that actually is a good question. The example I showed there, and again, I was hitting the tips of a lot of icebergs, but stratifying on geomorphic features would be exactly the same type of a problem as dividing the site up into habitat characteristics and types. And at one site, I know for sure, we also layered in kind of some exposure assumptions, like areas that were heavily wooded and unlikely for people to be going through. You know, you would weight those a little differently in your SWAC calculation. You know, downweight those areas relative to other areas that are more likely to be commonly used, and then integrate across that. So the stratification is a way to get at those kinds of questions.
All right. Well, thank you, John. I appreciate your insight into the statistical methods. And for those of you who may still have questions, please feel free to enter them, and we'll try to get back to them later on. All right. So our next speaker is going to be Rob Burgess from ORD, and he'll talk about passive sampling and poor water remedial guidelines. So Rob, you on the line?
Yes, I am, Jim.
Great.
Okay, well, thank you, Jim, and good afternoon to everybody. And as Jim said, I'll be talking about the role of passive sampling in long-term monitoring. And so as way of an outline of what I'll be talking about this afternoon, I'll talk about what passive sampling tells us, why do we care about the freely dissolved concentration, what we call the C-free. I'll talk about that for a moment or two. Then I'll get more into some of the pragmatic and logistical aspects of passive sampling, so the preparation, deployment, recovery, and storing of the samplers. And then I'll wrap up with a couple of examples of applications of passive sampling and long-term monitoring. And I did want to emphasize for the next few minutes what I'll be talking about in terms of contaminants are the non-ionic organic contaminants, so the PCBs, the PAHs, chlorinated pesticides, dioxins, those sorts of compounds that show up in contaminated sediment sites. There are passive sampling methods for metals, but they're just not as well developed as for the organics, so we won't talk about those today. So first of all, I wanted to talk about what passive sampling tells us, and it tells us at least two things. The first is the freely dissolved concentration of contaminants of concern in the water around the sampler, and it turns out that this is a pretty good surrogate for the bioavailable concentration of those contaminants. And this has been shown for pore waters or interstitial waters, as well as the water column. And what we can do is take that C-free value from a given pore water and compare it to, say, a water quality criteria or some other water quality standard or sediment guideline or any sort of water-only toxicity data and check for exceedances to see if that C-free value is exceeding some sort of criteria value. The other thing that we can do with passive sampler data, or the other thing that passive samplers tell us, I should say, is the concentration of contaminants of concern in the passive sampler, which seems kind of obvious. You're analyzing the passive sampler, and you find out how much PCB is in it, how much pH is in it. But it turns out that quantity also correlates fairly well with the concentrations that bioaccumulate in aquatic organisms. So we could see in some applications and in some circumstances using passive samplers as surrogates for biomonitoring organisms at contaminated sites. And based on literature reviews, this has been shown to be true for benthic and water column organisms. And more recently, again through literature reviews, it's been shown that this is also true for fish consumed by humans. Okay, next I want to go on to why do we care about the freely dissolved concentration. Again, this quantity we call C-free that I just mentioned is one of the things that the passive sampler can tell us. The webinar series is dedicated to contaminated sediments, so if we consider four benthic organisms, what media is an effective surrogate for exposure to the chemicals that are bioavailable? For these creatures, is it the sediments that they're living in? Is it the food they eat? Or is it the pore water that surrounds them in the interstitial waters or in the sediments themselves, I should say? And just to point out, if we collect the pore water carefully and correctly, we are actually measuring the freely dissolved concentration, that is, that C-free value that the passive samplers tell us. So fortunately, in the early 1980s, Bill Adams looked at this question, and several other researchers have followed up and verified his results, but his study was really the first one, so we'll talk about that for a minute or two. So what Adams did is he took two ketone amended sediments, and both sediments had the same level of ketone in them, and the pesticide ketones over here in the corner, the lower left. They had identical concentrations of ketone in them, but the difference between the sediments was the amount of organic carbon. One had a low level, 1.5%, and another one had high level, 12.3%. He used the freshwater midge to look at the effects of the ketone due to the sediment and the presence of toxicity that was in the sediment. And he developed a variety of exposure-response relationships between the organism's response and the presence of the chemical. What we will focus on today is just on the survival versus exposure part of his data set. So what we'll do now is just look at some of Adam's data. On the y-axis, we have midge survival in percent. And then on the x-axis, for now, we have sediment concentration, and this is in milligrams, ketone per kilogram dry sediment. And this is sort of the classic way we present contaminated sediment toxicity data. And now we'll look at the dose response curves that Adams generated. So first of all, the low organic carbon sediment, and he got this dose response curve. And next, the high organic carbon sediment, and he got this dose response curve. And these curves are very different from one another. And if the whole sediment, the sediment concentration, was really expressing the bioavailable concentration of the contaminant, we'd expect these dose response curves to be closer to one another, and we don't see that. So when Adams asked, you know, what media is an effective surrogate for exposure to these bioavailable chemicals, in this case ketone, in these two sediments, well, at least presenting the data this way, he found sediment was not, whole sediment measures were not useful. He also looked at the food, that also was not useful. And then he said, well, let's look at the data differently. Let's look at the pore water concentration rather than the whole sediment concentration. So we'll put that onto our x-axis. So now we have pore water concentration, micrograms ketone per liter of pore water, and we'll look at the dose response curves that result. First, the low organic carbon sediment, and now the high organic carbon sediment. And so now we have these two dose response curves that are very similar, yeah, based on, you know, the variability associated with aquatic toxicity testing, we'd say these curves are identical. So when Adams went back to his question, what media is an effective surrogate for exposure to bioavailable chemicals, the answer was the pore waters. And again, if we measure the pore waters carefully and effectively, we're measuring the freely dissolved concentration. And this gets back to the passive samplers. This is what the passive samplers tell us is the freely dissolved concentration, the C-free. All right, want to move on to some of the more practical, logistical issues, as I mentioned earlier, and that's just to talk about sort of the process of preparing, deploying, recovering, and storing passive samplers. And the first point I want to make is that there's nothing really super novel about passive sampling, especially if we look at the chemical analyses, the lower tier of this figure. These types of analyses are very similar to what commercial labs do now, for contaminated sediment analysis or contaminated tissue analysis. So again, nothing super novel. But anyway, starting up in the upper left-hand corner, we start with our passive sampler. In this case, I show a piece of PE or polyethylene, one of the common passive samplers. We next go to clean it, just to make sure it's not contaminated before it's deployed. Then we do the deployment and recovery. So a deployment of 30 days in the field is kind of the average. After the recovery of the samplers, they can be put into storage at -4 degrees C and left that way until you're ready or the lab is ready to analyze them. Once they are ready to analyze them, it involves just a simple solvent extraction, followed by a volume reduction, and then, of course, the quantification, usually by GC mass spec with data analysis and in the follow-up with interpretation. So again, the last part of this, the analytical part, is nothing too new to a lot of commercial laboratories once they get used to the actual passive sampler as a sample type. Next, I just want to go through some cartoons showing what the samplers look like when they're deployed. We'll start with the water column. So starting on the left-hand side, we have a sampler that has been attached to a steel ring, and then that steel ring is deployed up in the water column. Next, in the middle, we have a minnow trap deployment where you put the passive samplers inside a minnow trap and again suspend them up in the water column for the duration of the deployment. And this is done sometimes if you're concerned about fish or turtles taking bites out of the samplers, and that has happened at some sites. And finally, we have these copper tubes that have stainless steel mesh wrapped around them. The passive samplers can be put into those and then again suspended up in the water column as shown. I also want to show you the pore water deployments, probably the most important ones. There's a range and a variety of ways of deploying samplers in sediments. Two of the most common are first to start with some sort of frame, aluminum or stainless steel, where the passive sampler is in the window that you can see here, and then that is pushed into the sediment. The other is going back to that copper tube with the mesh, and again, this is put together, the passive sampler is inside of it, and then that can be pushed right into the sediment for the duration of the deployment. Okay, I think at this point some questions should be showing up. And let me ruining the surprise here a little bit. So the first question is, how many Superfund sites have used passive sampling?
John, there's quite a Rob, there's quite a range of different answers there.
There is.
A lot of folks, yeah, a lot of folks think there's just a few sites. What do you think?
Yeah, if we go to the next slide, and I've not seen the slide right now. Oh, there we go. This slide right here. Oops. The slides are getting out of here. Okay, slide 9. Okay, slide 9 shows a tabulation. This was put together by Matt Lambert in Osrati. This is a database he's been maintaining. It was updated just last month, so in October 2019. And there are 29 sites around the country, Superfund sites, that have been using passive sampling. So it's actually fairly extensive usage. It's across the country. I think just about every region is using them in one way or another. The next question on our list is which sampler is the most commonly used? And if we go to the next slide, so this is slide 10. What I did in this case is I just went to the scientific literature and did a search. So on the y-axis, we have the number of publications that the samplers have shown up in, and then on the x-axis, we have the year from 2003 until 2019. And just keep in mind, 2019 isn't over yet, so that data, that column is not complete, I guess we'd say. And what we can see, if you look at primarily the green and the bluish columns, those are the polydimethyl siloxane. It's also the type of passive sampler that uses what we call SPEMI, solid phase microextraction, and also polyethylene. So those two seem to be the most common types of samplers used right now. PDMS, SPEMI is very fast, so that can be handy in terms of equilibrating. That can be handy in some applications, while polyethylene is very inexpensive and very cost-effective. And then I think there's one more final question, how a passive sampler has been used at Superfund sites, and I think this is asking for written answers if people want to put something down.
And I'll just remind the audience that as you start to see responses come in from other people, you can actually hover your cursor over a response. You'll see a plus one to the right, and you can vote or agree with those responses. So we'll give the audience a few seconds here to sort of type in and review and click that plus one to vote or also chime in with how you've been using those passive samplers at sites.
Rob, it looks like a lot of people use it for site characterization.
Yep, I would agree. And if we go to the next slide, here is a figure that summarizes, going back to Matt Lambert's data set. So we have number of sites on the y-axis, and then across the bottom I have some sort of pre-categorized uses. So we have site assessment, remedy effectiveness, flux measurements, and also toxicity bioaccumulation. And I think you can see, at least right now, based on a sample size of 22 sites, most commonly is remedy effectiveness and flux measurements. So thank you. Thanks for your input on that. And finally, I'm just going to wrap up with a couple of slides on applications of passive sampling for long-term monitoring. The first is the use of passive sampling as a surrogate for deploying organisms in biomonitoring. This is something I talked about a moment ago, I think during the introduction. Advantages, year-round deployments, deployments can be done under toxic and low oxygen conditions, low dissolved oxygen conditions, and cost effective. So those are all the advantages of passive sampling. Disadvantage is the potential loss of environmental relevance because we are using the passive sampler, piece of plastic, as a surrogate for your biomonitoring organism, even though there's quite a bit of literature saying that that's not such a bad assumption. We've been looking at this question at the New Bedford Harbor Superfund site. It's a PCB site in Region 1. Water column biomonitoring with the blue mussel has been occurring since the early 1990s at three of the stations there. And in 2014, we started assessing the use of passive sampling, doing parallel deployments of both passive samplers and the mussels. This is an ongoing study, so I don't really have any data to show you per se, but just to give you a sense of the design, we have total PCBs on the y-axis here, nanograms per gram lipid or polymer, depending if you're looking at the mussels or if you're looking at the passive sampler. And then on the x-axis, we have the year. And so, as I said, we have about 25 years of mussel data. And then starting in 2014, we've been doing these parallel deployments. And the goal is to evaluate the relationship between the passive samplers and the mussels and provide guidance to RPMs as to how to use passive sampling in this particular long-term monitoring application. Okay, the final application I'll go through is the use of passive sampling to measure contaminant fluxes and capping effectiveness in long-term monitoring. Looking on the left-hand side of the slide, we have depth in centimeters up into the water column and down into the sediment in these two cartoons. And in the first, on the left-hand side of the cartoon, we're just showing how PCBs, in this case, will migrate out of the sediments and go someplace else and contaminate another part of the environment. We can use passive sampling to ask the question, the magnitude of the transfer of contaminants to the water column. Another question we can ask is on the right-hand side. And we have a similar setup. We have a water column. We have a sediment and pore water. But now a cap has been put in place. And the cap is intended to keep the contaminants in place, obviously. And we can ask, using passive samplers, about how effective is that cap. And a way to do that is using following design. So we have our frame here that I showed you a moment ago, this aluminum or stainless steel frame, the passive sampler in the window. We then deploy it in the environment with part of the sampler in the water column, part of the sampler below the sediment water interface, deploy it for, as I said earlier, 30 days or so. And then you recover the sampler, slice it into horizontal pieces, and analyze each of those pieces as an individual sample. And when you do that, you may get some data that looks like this. This is from the Palos Verdes Shelf Superfund site. We have depth on the y-axis again. But now on the x-axis, we actually have DDE C-free concentrations. So these are actual concentrations of DDE that in the C-free form, right from the passive sampler. This is passive sampling data. And it's in nanograms per liter. And so in the sediment, we have a profile as shown. Up in the water column, we have another profile. Because there's a difference between these concentrations in the water column and in the sediment, we know there's going to be a flux between those two from the sediment up into the water column. And in fact, using the passive sampler data at this site, we're able to calculate a flux of 260 nanograms of DDE per centimeter squared per year. This type of analysis has been done at other sites, including the Lower Duwamish in Region 10, Grass River and Dover Gaslight, in Grass River in Region 2, and Dover Gaslight in Region 3. So it is something that has been used in the field on several occasions now. So that's what I have for slides. I'll take any questions before Lawrence takes over and talks a little bit more about passive sampling and a whole lot about remedial guidelines. So thank you for your attention.
Thanks, Rob. We did have a couple of questions. One of them kind of goes back to some basic concepts of passive samplers. Now, many of us are familiar with the polyethylene bag samplers that are used in monitoring wells that are based on the principle of diffusion of smaller molecules through PE. Could you describe very briefly the other types of passive samplers and the modes of how they capture contaminants?
Sure. So, and Jim, just to make sure I understand the question, so you noted that you're familiar with polyethylene samplers, is that right?
Yes.
Okay.
One of the, a couple of the participants noted that they're familiar with the passive samplers that allow fluid to move across through the semipermeable barrier.
Okay. Well, the interest, I guess a good thing about passive samplers, the primary ones that we use in the United States or North America, they all basically work the same way. So that's the polyethylene, the polydimethyl siloxane, and polyoxymethylene samplers. So it's PE, PDMS, and POM are the acronyms for those three samplers. They all basically work the same way, which is the contaminant partitions from the water phase into the polymer matrix, into that plastic, and there it accumulates until it equilibrates with the concentration that was outside in the water phase. The reason, I guess to get a little bit more fundamental, the reason that system works is that the contaminants, and if we're talking PCBs, they're basically hydrocarbons, they don't want to be dissolved in water. They chemically have a very low affinity for the water phase, whereas they have a very high affinity for other hydrocarbons. And most passive samplers, be it PDMS or polyethylene, are a form of hydrocarbon. So the contaminants simply partition from the water phase into that polymer phase, and there they're more thermodynamically happy, you could say, or more stable, and they accumulate, and as I said, at some point you reach an equilibrium where there's the amount of contaminant going into the sampler is equivalent to any of the contaminant that's repartitioning back out into the water. And once you reach that equilibrium state, that's when we can go ahead and calculate the C-free concentration. So I guess to just emphasize some fundamental points, all of the passive samplers that are used commonly in North America and in the United States basically work under the premise I just described to you. It's basically they're very hydrophobic. The contaminants are hydrophobic. The sampler is a hydrophobic medium, and the contaminants rather be in that hydrophobic medium than in the water, either pore water or the water column. I hope that gets to the question.
That did answer the question, and actually you just answered another question about whether passive samplers are applicable to just the sediments or water column. It sounds like they're applicable to both based on your flux.
Yes, absolutely, and, which is another nice aspect about the most commonly used samplers. We used to have the SPMDs, the semipermeable membrane devices. Those were some of the first passive samplers, and those are basically a polyethylene tubing that has an artificial lipid inside. Triolein was the most common one. Those were very effective passive samplers for water column deployments, but when we became interested in sediment deployments, sticking samplers into the mud, sometimes SPMDs were problematic because they would rip and you would lose some of that triolein, and that would make the data that you received after the deployment relatively unuseful. All the other samplers, the SPME, the POM, the PE, can be deployed relatively easily, both in the water column and directly in the sediment.
Okay. Well, thanks. We do have a couple of other questions, but I want to move on to Lawrence's presentation in the interest of time. Now, folks, if you do have some further questions, please feel free to place them in the Q&A section over here on the right, and we'll try to get to them at the end of the presentations. So now I'd like to turn it over to Lawrence, who will continue the discussion of poor water remedial goals.
Thank you. Can you hear me?
Can hear you just great, Lawrence.
Okay. You can see the title here, and I'll move on. I thought I have a quick question. How many people here are on the line use toxicity testing at their site? And looks like a lot of folks, 75-80% of us, so which is good. We'll move on here. The goal today is, in this short presentation, is to show how poor water remedial goals and toxicity testing data can be examined together. And when they are consistent with each other, we can be reasonably assured that the causes of toxicity are identified properly and that the poor water remedial goals will be protective of benthic organisms at the site. What I'm talking about is summarized in a recently published guidance document, and it has two basic parts. First, there's talks about how to measure freely dissolved chemical in the sediment pore water, and that's what Rob Burgess just got done talking about. I'm going to be talking today a little bit about the threshold concentrations that delineate between acceptable and unacceptable. In the guidance, we're using or defining acceptable and unacceptable thresholds, and we're taking those from EPA's ambient water quality criteria for aquatic life. And I have here the species sensitivity distribution for endrin, and this is for freshwater species. And the water quality criteria uses the fifth percentile value from the distribution. And for this particular chemical, the way it was derived was they have a distribution for acute values, and the fifth percentile value was 0.1803 micrograms per liter, using a derived measured acute to chronic ratio of 3.1. A final chronic value was derived of 0.058. That's how water quality criteria are used, and the final chronic value would be used in deriving a poor water remedial goal. One of the interesting things and things you should note is that when you start looking at toxicity testing data, and I have listed here common species that are used in sediment toxicity testing, the fifth percentile from the ambient water quality for pH mixtures is below that for the commonly tested species. And you can see that it's, depending on what species you're using, it can be drastically different. That has important implications. This methodology that I'm talking about has been integrated into Superfund's 8-step ERE guidance. And in the first step, where you would be characterizing the nature and extent of contamination, what you do in order to implement this methodology, you would be measuring the fraction of organic carbon in your sediment, and as well as the concentration in the bulk sediment of the COCs of concern. And then you would compute the organic carbon normalized concentrations. In step two, the screening level risk assessment, you would compute toxic units, and for a single toxicant, the toxic units is basically determined by dividing the concentration in the sediment on an organic carbon basis by the ESB. ESB, for those who do not know, is the sediment equilibrium benchmark, and these were developed by EPA in the early 2000s. They use equilibrium partitioning theory, and basically this method assumes all organic carbon in the sediment is from diagenesis of plant materials. With this assumption implicit, it's conservative, and it has units of microgram per gram organic carbon. For a mixture of toxicants, you would compute the toxic units for each of the individual components as shown. Have an arrow. Yes, thank you. Shown here for each component, and then you'd sum the total toxic units. In step five in this methodology, you would then go out and passively sample surface sediment samples where the total TUs are greater than one. So in essence, we're using the equilibrium sediment benchmarks is a screening tool to narrow down the number of samples that you would actually passively sample. In the baseline ecologic risk assessment, you would then compute toxic units for the chemicals of concern. And now, rather than using the ESB, we're using the final chronic value from the ambient water quality criteria. And for a single toxicant, it would be the C3 that you'd measure using passive sampling, as found by the methods Rob described. For a mixture of toxicants, it's the same math, but now you do it for each individual component, and then you would sum the total toxic units across the whole mixture. And for locations where the total TUs is less than one, there's little potential risk of benthic organisms. And greater than one, you would say that we have unacceptable risk to benthic organisms, and you would proceed to goal development. I'm only going to talk about development of remedial goals for bulk sediment, but we do provide in the guidance methods that provide driving remedial goals based upon freely dissolved concentrations in the pore water or concentrations in the sediment on an organic carbon normalized basis. I'm only going to talk about the bulk basis today just for sake of time. So what you would need to do is derive a site-specific fraction of organic carbon for your site, and that could involve some number of different calculations. It could be a SWAC. It could be a number of ways of deriving it. And then you would also need to know the partitioning between organic carbon in the sediment and the pore water at the site. And I show here the formula for deriving that partition coefficient. For a single toxicant, you would derive the remedial goal, just taking the product of the partition coefficient, the fraction of organic carbon, and the C-free pore water value. And then for a single toxicant, that would be equal to the final chronic value from the ambient water quality criteria. Similarly, you could just essentially just take the bulk concentration and divide it by the total toxic units in the sample. That would give you your pore water remedial goal. The math is the same. For a mixture, it's the same math, but just you've got to do each individual chemical. And so I've shown here basically doing that there. And then you would sum the concentration of each individual component in the mixture. So if I have over here just an example, if your total toxic units of your mixture is 58.7 toxic units, you would basically take 1.7% of the bulk concentrations in your sample for each individual component and sum those to get the final concentration for your remedial goal for the mixture. When turning to toxicity testing results, I show here some results from some work done in 2007. And this is for high-low survival 28-day day. And on the x-axis, I have toxic units based upon pore water measurements derived using the ambient water quality final chronic value. And what you can see is that we have a nice dose response curve here, but the toxic units are not centered around one, but rather around a much higher value. If I plop down on this plot, the actual toxicity associated with Hialeah, and we know from the previous slides, that they are less sensitive than the fifth percentile, you can see where that value sits. And the green arrow here is the toxicity, major toxicity for Hialeah. And that kind of shows that the data is consistent with what we expect toxicologically for the sediments and based upon the pore water measurements. If we go further and use, rather than the final chronic value from the ambient water quality, but rather use the actual toxicity value for Hialeah, these things then center around one and provide a very nice dose response curve. The other thing here is that now by using the Hialeah toxicity, it's centered around one and it follows a nice dose response relationship. Now, if you're looking at your data and you think you're using Hialeah, if you get green or red points here, that would suggest that you have other toxicants or misidentified the toxicants, and this is, you get complicated sites. These types of things are not unusual. And when you have points that reside like this, you have not really demonstrated consistency of your toxicity results in terms of what you're thinking the toxicants are and what the actual causes of toxicity are. To give you some feel for that, I have shown here in this slide 28-day survival. This is again for Hialeah Well, we're 97 samples from 6 NPG and 2 aluminum smelter sites. And I've now computed the toxic units using measured pore water concentrations and using the toxicity associated for pHs for high level. And you can see that this data does. The breakpoint aligns with very close to 1, and it forms a nice dose response curve, and it is behaving as we would expect if pHs are the mixture. Because this whole virtual seminar is on term monitoring, how does this fit into you, the end user, using this information? Well, with a pore water reader well, you know the breakpoints between acceptable and unacceptable exposures, and these are site-specific determinations, and these could be derived, as I said before, on the bulk basis, on a pore water basis, or if you want to, on an organic carbon normalized basis. In a long-term monitoring program, what you do, of course, is you monitor concentrations over time, and you can monitor concentrations in the pore water, or you can monitor them in the bulk sediment, knowing your PRGs, and document whether you're at acceptable goals or whether you're approaching acceptable goals. And what this combination of pore water testing and toxicity testing, this might allow you to do a little less toxicity testing, which is a little more labor intensive than passive sampling in your monitoring programs. So to summarize, when pore water reader goals and toxicity data are consistent, i.e. they form a nice dose response relationship and they're centered around 1, you're reasonably sure that the causes of toxicity at your site are properly identified and that these remedial goals will be protected of benthic organisms at the site. It's important to note that these pore water goals account for contaminant bioavailability considerations at your site caused by other forms of carbon or other issues going on at your site. So with that, I'm going to give some time for questions, and we can go from there.
Sure, Lawrence. We do have a couple of questions for you. So we had a question come in regarding a remediation system that might employ some activated carbon in a sediment remedy. So it seems that the KOC would differ for the remediated sediments. The sediment cleanup goal back calculated with the C-free and the site natural FOC would differ with the addition of the activated carbon. Is that correct?
Yes, that is absolutely correct. When you add activated carbon, the partition coefficient would go up, increased by probably orders of magnitude, 1 or 2 maybe, depending on the type of carbon. And what that does is it drives down the freely dissolved concentration. And so this is a very commonly discussed and evolving technique right now of adding activated carbon to a cap or to sediments directly to reduce the pore water concentration. And by reducing the pore water concentration, you will drive down the toxicity associated with those contaminants.
Okay. So one of your slides, you showed the relationship between the toxicity and survival. And you had that one there. And the understanding here is that the pAH would be responsible for this dose response curve.
That is correct.
What would this curve look like if you had additional contaminants? Because many of our sites might have multiple toxicity drivers in the sediment. What would you expect, and then how would you address that?
Well, I'll go back to this slide here. We know that the triangles here are calculated or based upon pH measurements in the pore water. If you had a point here, like the red or the green, you would let's start with the red. This would suggest that you have the wrong toxicants identified, because if you're having survival up here, that means that it's that there probably aren't PAHs there driving the toxicity. There's something else. There's something else there. And both these, the natural step would be to do some type of toxicity identification, a TIE, on your sediment samples to figure out what is in there, especially for this one here where you have a lot of toxicity with no PAHs. That would suggest you have something else, and I'd be looking for another toxicant. And when you get into complicated sites, this is not unexpected. And causes of toxicity with PAHs, if you get in a situation where you have NAPL present, NAPL can cause suffocation of the hyalella. So it basically just gum up their whole filter breathing system. That is not a mode of toxicity due to narcosis. But rather a physical effect. And it would take some work. You would have to do some work to resolve what is causing the toxicity.
Okay, so that might include some additional testing.
Testing and analytical work, yes.
Okay. So we did have a couple of questions that came in regarding SWACs. John, are you still on the line?
No, John's not on the line.
Okay. All right. We have a couple of questions about PWRGs. Have PWRGs been established at any Superfund sites, or PWRG theoretical at this point? And can you give us some examples of where they might have been used at Superfund sites?
They have not. I don't know of a site where they've actually been applied as a remedial goal yet. I have worked with a number of sites where we have done the calculation for PAHs and shown that the toxicity data does jive with what we expect the toxicity to be, giving you a nice, well-defined dose-response relationship. The data behaving like this here.
Uh-huh.
And so the methodology that I'm talking about came out in 97, and we love to get involved in the number of sites using this, because I think we could make some big headway for everybody in demonstrating the usefulness and the utility of this methodology.
So you'd be looking for an actual site where you could collect data and then run this sort of analysis, is that correct?
Absolutely, yeah.
Well, I guess that's a great challenge for our participants. If you have a site with sediment toxicity issues that might benefit from this approach, we'd love for you to get in contact with Lawrence or somebody, and perhaps we could address that.
Yep, absolutely.
Okay. All right. I don't see any other questions for you right now. So
okay,
let me open
you
up the discussion. All right. So thank you very much. And I'd like to move on to our final speaker for the afternoon. And that will be Mark Mills from EPA's ORD. And Mark is going to talk about long-term measures of remedy effectiveness, specifically lines of evidence that can be used. Mark, you on the line?
Yes, I am. Thank you.
Great.
All right. So we'll go ahead and get started. We've had some great speakers talking about some of the different lines of evidence that I will discuss, so I don't have to go in a lot of detail. I'm going to use a case study as one example of doing that, and I'll discuss a little bit about the framework of how we've initiated this work. So we're talking about multiple lines of evidence as described here, and aligning those through a weight of evidence approach. So some of the biological lines of evidence is basically assessing biological endpoints such as fishery productivity, diversities of species, toxicity, et cetera. There can be multiple, and it will be largely site-specific. All of these lines of evidence will be dependent upon particular characteristics of your site. Under chemical lines of evidence, we have things such as contaminant concentrations, post-remedy surface-weighted average concentrations, as was discussed earlier, reductions in fish tissue, as well as others. And I'll give some examples here in a minute of somewhat of these that are more routine versus some of those that are more advanced or are currently being conducted as research. In addition, physical lines of evidence, these are sort of the things that are done at a contaminated site that usually involve moving mud, so things like volumes or mass removed of the contaminant, pounds of PCBs, for example, or cubic yards of sediment capped, et cetera. Modeling, which I won't talk a whole lot about, but there are both physical and hydrodynamic models that could be used as a line of evidence, as well as performance modeling, if you want to think about things like one-dimensional models of migration through caps, or even things such as food web modeling to look at recovery of the food web after a remedial action. I'll go through some brief examples here, and as we move into the case study, you'll see some of both the current practice and the more innovative. So sort of some of the current practices that would be considered for biological lines of evidence would be things such as fish tissue for human consumption advisories, some standard sediment toxicity and bioaccumulation testing, some of which Larry touched on, benthic surveys, so taking a look at what macrobenthic population would be as compared to what it would be in an uncontaminated site or a reference condition. Histopathology is also another common endpoint, so looking at things like tumors, lesions, as shown in the one picture at the top right, we have a bullhead here that has a lesion on its lower lip. More innovative examples might be things monitoring benthic body burden throughout the food web, considering short-lived fish as an indicator species, and I'll talk a little bit about that as I get to the case study. Looking at alternate endpoints for bioaccumulation, and Lawrence did a good job of talking about how those might be used with passive samplers or other surrogate measures. Things such as IBI, habitat quality, or even things like genetic damage. We've done a little bit of work looking at things like at the COMET assay and as an indicator. Benthic surveys, I mentioned previously, but things like lacustrine ICI is something that's very specific to the particular habitat or the particular condition that your particular site is in. Monitoring versus bivalve, or using bivalves, not quite as innovative as it once was. I mean, there's a number of examples where people are using mussels or clams as a bioindicator. Riparian indicators, things such as avian species, swallows, or terrestrial spiders that are feeding off the aquatic food web might be an indicator of a riparian indicator. I'll touch upon spiders specifically here in the case study. And then developing some standardized SOPs, QAQC, and interlab comparisons. We do notice that there are issues at times when changing methods over the lifetime of a project can cause issues with interpreting results or changing QAQC requirements, detection limits that are dropping over time, and the issue of interlab variability. And then finally, reference locations, which can be challenging depending upon the particular site or the location that you're trying to do your remediation. For chemical lines of evidence, some current practices are sediment chemistry, some of the things we were talking about earlier with regard to surface-weighted versus segmented coring sampling, and water chemistry. These would be pretty routine measurements if you're doing a contaminated sediment site. The more innovative, as opposed to using passive samplers as a surrogate for biology, potentially using them as an indicator of poor water or using them as part of an identification of hotspots, that sort of thing. Poor water measurements in general, both direct and passive sampling approaches. Direct measurements of poor water are difficult and vary widely as Rob was explaining earlier, moving towards a passive sampling approach. Oops, I don't have a pointer either. If somebody can help me on that end. There we go. Whoop, there it is. Poor water is, as we're moving towards the possibility of using passive samplers as a standardizing approach to look at C3 concentrations, measuring groundwater surface water interactions through things like groundwater intrusion. This could be groundwater moving, contaminated groundwater moving into a particular site, or clean water moving through contaminated sediments resulting in contamination of the surface water. Using some forensic chemistry to look at things such as legacy contaminants versus emerging contaminants, or other chemical indicators might be a better way to say this, is using some of those forensic approaches to understand more fully exactly what the physical, chemical, and biological processes that are going on at a particular site. Rapid screening might be another area where maybe you can do some direct analysis or in-field screening techniques in order to move more quickly. Qualitative screening, maybe you don't need to know exactly what the concentration is down to the decimal point. Maybe you can get away with a qualitative screening in order to be able to do either routine monitoring or to define extent. I mentioned a little bit on forensics, but generally, if you start moving into more advanced chemical forensics, this isn't something you would normally do at every site, or if you do use it on a site, you wouldn't use it necessarily at every location because of the cost and time associated with processing these kinds of samples. I'll move on to the next one. Some physical lines of evidence. Some current practices are things like single beam bathymetry in order to measure whether or not a cap has been placed to the right thickness, or whether a dredge has reached the appropriate cut line. There's often turbidity measurements to look at whether a dredge or a cap operation may be changing turbidity, or whether there's turbidity which may contribute to contaminant transport during storm events. So those sorts of measurements have sort of been around for a while. And then some sediment transport modeling, understanding sort of conceptually where and how sediment is moving and its potential for moving contaminants in the system. Maybe some more innovative examples might be things like particle tracking. There are techniques where you can monitor individual particles. Those could be potentially distributed in the system to look for movement. They could be integrated into a cap. They could be released during dredging to understand near-field versus far-field transport. This could be particle tracking. Often is done in conjunction with measures of hydrodynamics and other plume monitoring. I mentioned groundwater surface water interactions. In this case, we're not talking about contaminant movement, but just simply understanding how water is moving. That could be through pulse chase kind of scenarios, or heat temperature profiles, et cetera, that can be used to understand exactly how water is moving and how that would influence the poor water and potentially the bioenergy in the system. Things like sediment traps have been used in some instances, although there are limitations with certain designs, and there are certainly considerations that need to be used in the interpretation of those sorts of results, but they can be informative and have been used in some instances. The implementation of multi-beam bathymetry, though more expensive and sort of more data intensive to deal with, provides higher resolution information, especially as we start investing in things such as thin layer capping, or as was mentioned earlier, the addition of granular activated carbon, where maybe we're not adding feet and therefore we need higher resolution. These may be opportunities. We've also used some techniques such as side scan sonar to look at, as an example, in the middle pane. Oops. I've got my pointer moving, but here where we're looking at sort of the cut face and understanding how that dredge may result in sloughing or movement of contaminant, resuspension of contaminants that are being dredged. So those are some additional examples of more innovative approaches. Okay, so I'll move on to case study because there's a lot of information there. I'm not going to have time to cover all of those techniques, so I'm going to show a little bit of how we did some of the chemical and biological measurements associated with this particular project. So this is the Great Lakes Legacy Act River, or Ottawa River project that was done through the Great Lakes Natural Program Office on the Maumee River area of concern. It was a dredging, primarily a dredging project with some sort of natural recovery for those areas with lower concentrations that was conducted from 2009 to 2010 was the active engineering that was going on, or the dredging activity that was going on. And it was over just over 5 miles of the river, reaches 2 through 4. The primary contaminants of concern at this site were PCBs, PAHs, inorganics, and oil and grease. As shown here, about 260,000 cubic yards of contaminated sediment were removed from the area. They went through a dewatering step, and the sediments were dewatered. The water then was treated and discharged back into the river. These sediments remained in place at a landfill near the river. As I mentioned, it was dredging. This was primarily in targeted areas, which I'll show in just 1 minute. It was not bank-to-bank, top-to-bottom. It was intended to be areas that were above specific thresholds. So this gives just an overview map of the areas. The one thing that is not on here is the dredge prisms themselves, but I have identified the locations where we were using, where we were monitoring for our long-term monitoring project. So an important differentiation as I talk through the rest of the data is that the dredged areas where dredging activity did occur to varying depths are indicated in yellow. So these yellow indications that this is an area that was dredged and we were monitoring it over the long term. Importantly also is these non-dredge areas, these areas that are indicated with a red, those are areas that were expected to recover over time as these higher concentration areas were dredged and removed. I'll move on to the next one. I'll give you just conceptually a little bit on how we designed some of the biological monitoring that we did. We were, in essence, taking a food web approach, the idea being that as you move down to the lower ends of the food web, the spatial representation of the information you get from monitoring at this end of the food web is going to be generally in the meters to tens of meters. So if you start looking at biofilms or you look at macrobenthos, you're probably talking tens to 100 meters. As you start moving up the food web, these organisms are feeding on prey and therefore sort of are collecting the information that you would have been collecting here. So we're looking at spiders, birds, or smaller short-lived fish lower in the food web. Now we might be working on hundreds of meters to kilometer distances, and as we move finally up to the top of the food web, we could be in tens to hundreds of meters depending on the lifestyle and feeding styles of these particular fish. On the temporal scale, it's also an important consideration is that as you move down the food web, you tend to end up with noisier data. And these data tend to be responding to changes within days to weeks. As you move up and you start looking at lifestyle or lifespans of some of these organisms, such as macrobenthos or spiders, you might be in the months to a year time frame. You continue to move up the food web, you're in the years, and then even at the very top, depending on your apex predators, you could be in years to decades. And so one of the parts of the research questions that we had is, can we work across this food web, both spatially and temporally, in order to see whether we were seeing recovery in some aspects of the food web that eventually would cascade into the higher levels of the food web. So for this particular one, I'll start with the fish that we were collecting at the top. We were one of our primary apex predators was largemouth bass. Then we had a number of other sort of longer-lived, higher trophic level fish, such as pumpkin seed and sucker and bullhead. And then we continued to move down the food web into gizzard shad, emerald shiner, blunt-nosed minnow. Further yet down, we did some work on some spiders that were in the riparian zone. And I guess I should have noted that, so I talked about this, the information on the biological indicator, but also a little bit of information on the numbers of samples that were collected, in this case by reach, and then we were also using size classifications in order to get consistent aging. And I'll keep moving. So a little bit on the methods for the for collection. Fish were largely done either EPA or Fish and Wildlife through electroshocking. There were a number of species, especially the more bottom-dwelling species, that we were more effective at collecting those through fike nets, and so setting nets, nets and collecting those species multiple times throughout that year. And then ultimately the fish are sorted, logged, and processed, and eventually sent for chemistry, as well as in some cases some species were also, we looked at other indicators as well. For macrobenthos, we primarily use an artificial substrate, a Hestrodendi sort of device here, and it was deployed in one of two ways. One is in this grid system on top of a cinder block to be directly on top of the sediment. In some areas where we had, and this was primarily because we had shallow water, areas with a little bit more water column, we were able to deploy them, and these are basically fish cages, but similarly, they were deployed about a foot to a foot and a half off the surface. And they were deployed for 6 weeks. And then a crew went again, collected the organisms off the substrate, sorted and picked for a fixed amount of time with a goal of for PCBs and pHs to have greater than 1 gram of wet weight. We did use the COMET assay. I won't have any data to share as far as just out of time, but I will mention a conclusion later. But a COMET assay was used to look at genotoxic response of specific brown bullhead. So for those fish, we also collected blood and liver in the field. We went through a preservation of the sample in the field to get it stable and preserved for taking it back to the laboratory, and then went through a process of fluorescence microscopy to look at the COMET assay blood cells. And generally, is what we're looking at is that there's a number of indicators. One is the tail extent as there's more genetic damage. But there's a number of different other metrics that come off of this that can help indicate how much genetic damage there was to those particular organisms. Another biological line of evidence is looking at riparian predator spiders. In this particular case, we set up transects on either shoreline, so flow of the river going this way. We had four transects, 50 meters to 100 meter transects on either bank. Collecting those, these are aquatic specialists. This is a particular species here, Tetranathid. It's an aquatic specialist. It basically cannot live much more than 1 meter from the shoreline. It feeds almost exclusively on emergent insects from the aquatic system. And therefore, and we've done some studies previously to show that their isotopic signature from carbon nitrogen is showing that they're feeding almost 100% exclusively on emergent aquatic insects. So let's move into some of the results. Just briefly, some of the chemical lines evidence, we looked at PCBs in water and sediment, as mentioned, as kind of a traditional expected endpoint. It is important to note the majority of the dredging was occurring in 2010. So the throughout these slides, 2010 was sort of the end of 2009 through 2010 was the majority of the actual dredging activities on the river. So between dredging and the extensive amount of boat traffic, we did see an increase in PCBs in water in 2010 during action. But if you look, if you can visualize the graph without the 2010 data, you can basically see that from 2009 to 2015, we did see a reduction in water concentration. Similarly, for sediment, we're seeing a reduction, especially these areas. In yellow are the areas that were targeted because of higher concentrations in the surface sediment, but also in the subsurface sediment. The sediment results that I'm showing here are only the surface sediment results, so they're a little bit biased because they're not showing the higher concentrations that were at depth. But we can see that there was a significant reduction in sediment concentration in those areas that were targeted for dredging throughout the entire time of the monitoring program. For those areas that were not dredged, we basically saw little to no change throughout that same time period, indicating, I mean, these were not targeted and they were determined to be below the target concentration anyway. And so as expected, we didn't see much change there. If we were to continue, and we will, we have one more sampling period in 2020. We expect, though, however, that over long term, we would eventually see these red bars declining as well as the no dredge areas from monitored to natural recovery. Looking at the contaminants, primarily PCBs, there's a whole other set of data for PAHs and other contaminants, but again, for PCBs. For the macroinvertebrates, much noisier, as I mentioned. It's a little bit lower on the food web, so you see variations as, that are affected by short-term change. We do see the response to the dredging, and then it does take some time for that to start to decline. There's still some variability in the data, so it's a little bit hard. There is a general decrease in the mean value, but it is maybe within these error bars, and so whether that's statistically significant or not, it's a little bit hard to say with these particular data. But we'll have another data point here in 2020 that we hope will continue this trend down, and we hope that we'll see something that is below the pre-dredge condition of 2009. The spider concentrations largely reflect their prey, so we're seeing similarly, we're not seeing a whole lot of a trend here. We did see the increase in 2010, though it was very noisy, and we do see for the most part maybe a reduction in concentration, and we hope that by 2010 we'll see that that reduction continue in that downward trend. For short-lived fish, gizzard shad did see a reduction in concentrations from 2009 through 2015. We were not able to collect any in 2010, so we don't quite see the immediate response to the actual remedial activities. But we do see a general trend decreasing for the years that we do have gizzard shad. Emerald shiner, on the other hand, we do have the 2010 data. We do see that response from the remedy, but then also we see the reduction over time in emerald shiner, and similarly for blunt-nosed minnows. So indicating that these short-lived fish are seeing a response, their life cycle being 2 to 3 years, we would expect that as the hotspots are removed, we would see those reductions in concentrations over time. On the higher trophic level fish, a little bit slower in response, and that's to be expected as it takes some time to get through the food web. But we are seeing a general reduction in 2015 below that of 2009. And again, the goal is to go back in 2020, and we hope that that is a continuing trend downward. Brown bullhead, less so, and we're not entirely certain why that is for brown bullhead. They may not have as much site fidelity as some of these other species, so they may spend some of their time outside of the site, which means that they're not necessarily being impacted or altered by the remedy. We are similarly, we're seeing reductions in pumpkin seed. White sucker might be a similar case as the brown bullhead on how much site fidelity they have. But here are some of the data on the upper parts of the food web. I'll move through two more slides, and then we'll wrap this up. Another biological line of evidence, and this is one that's very specific for Ohio EPA that was developed as part of their Lacustrine Invertebrate Community Index. We've been working with the state of Ohio. They've got a long-term monitoring set for many of the stations or stations that are very consistent with the ones that we were monitoring. We generally don't see a huge change in that LICI value. The target here is this value of about 35, 36 here. In large part, it's that there's habitat issues aside from this is a highly urban system, low in river miles, and so therefore it's being impacted by a number of different things aside from the contaminants of concern. So maybe not a surprise that we didn't see a huge recovery in the LICI value, but one positive thing is we did not necessarily see a huge decrease. If you think about what dredging does, I mean, we're basically tearing out habitat. We're changing the benthic population pretty dramatically, and we're seeing that the good news is that even with the dramatic sort of intrusion associated with dredging for the benthos, we're not necessarily seeing these values change downwardly either. I'll move on to one final data slide. So this is it's a lot of data that we just went through. So one of the things we've done is to try to get a slightly different way to interpret this information. So just to walk people through the slide, we have pre-dredge PCB concentrations on the x-axis and post-dredge on the y-axis. This is a one-to-one line, so in essence, if we measured something and it was unchanged from pre-dredge to post-dredge, then we would expect it would just stay on that one-to-one line. So anything that begins to move below this one-to-one line indicates that we're moving towards recovery, that the system is improving when it comes to contaminant concentrations. And those things that move above this line indicate that we're seeing concentrations increasing over time, potentially. And to break that down a little bit more, we've got 2 years here, the 2013-2015 data. If we just look at sediment, I mentioned that was one of the more obvious ones. You can see clearly that sediment in the dredging and then areas for 2013 and 2015 are definitely below the one-to-one line, indicating that there has been a reduction in concentration. If you look at the non-dredge areas, on average, they're increasing slightly above where they were in this area. And this is likely, with these error bars, it's going to be a little bit hard to say that that's significantly different than what they started at. Similarly, we've looked at inverts, both in the non-dredge areas, which is a little hard, it's kind of clustered in here, versus the inverts in the dredged areas. So we are seeing an increase or a decrease in contaminant concentration in the macrobenthos in the dredged areas. We're largely seeing it unchanged in the dredged areas. And so similarly, all the other species that we were talking about, brown bullhead, gizzard shad, largemouth bass, et cetera, you can see sort of in general, we see things falling below the line, indicating that things are improving in those areas that we expect they would. I think I've covered most of these along the way, but we saw sediment decreases in water concentrations, either unchanged or slightly decreased for water, but largely decreased for sediment. The macroinvertebrate spider tissues were lower than pre-dredge conditions, but there's quite a bit of noise in those data, so it makes it a little bit difficult to interpret. I mentioned this, that despite the large physical disruption from the remedy or the dredging itself, there was no decline in the LICI values, but conversely, there was really no increase either, indicating that we're still a stressed environment for the LICI. Brown bullhead showed a trend towards a decrease in DNA damage. I did not show that data just because it would take some time to sort of walk through it, but suffice it to say, we see a general decrease in DNA damage, indicating that we have a reduction in the stressor. I mentioned the species that were responding from pre-dredge to post-dredge, and then based on some of the design models that were put together when they were designing the remedy, their goal was to be below their target clean levels at the 10-year mark, and that would be in 2020, which is why we're coming back one more time for sampling. And with that, I can take questions.
All right, so we're going to pause here for questions in just a moment. As soon as we get Jim Rice on the phone lines, we'll go ahead and take that brief Q&A break. I'll just remind everybody, if you do have a question or comment for our presenters, feel free to use the Q&A window in the lower right corner. You can see a number of questions have come in, but if you have additional ones, you still have time to enter them in. Rich, are you with us on the phone? Or pardon me, Jim, are you with us on the phone?
Yes. Yes. So, Mark, we had a couple of questions on some basic information in your presentation. Could you give a brief description of the COMET assay is and what data it provides?
Sure. I'll do about as much as an engineer can talk about toxicity. the general premise, let me go back to it, is that we're looking at blood cells from the organism. The idea being that as those cells, as the genetic damage is imparted on those cells, I'm pointing but nobody's seeing it. This tail will get longer because you have more fragments, and so you end up with, if you have it relative to a control, you can indicate what the genetic damage to those cells are. So it's very much on the research end of things right now as far as how to use this information, because we know that there's damage. We know that it's either increasing or decreasing. Putting that into context as far as what that means for tumor development or lesions or other erosion, you know, other things that might be more the histopath side of things, that's where some of the research is headed.
Okay, thanks. And the physical lines of evidence, what types of particles are used for the particle tracking? Somebody wanted to know just a little bit more about this particle tracking on the physical side.
Sure. Yeah, there's basically two technologies available currently. One of them is a fluorescence track, a fluorescence labeled particle. So you can collect sediment from your site. You can have it then labeled for fluorescent. They basically add a fluorescent label to the particle, and then you monitor with fluorescence as an indicator of whether those particles are moving around in your system. Alternatively, there is another technology that uses magnetic particles. They match to some of the particle size characteristics of your site, and then they use magnets basically in the field deployed strategically based on where they think flow will be headed, and then they recover those magnets and look at what particles have moved to those particular ones. It's been used in a few places. Both the vendors, both the folks that are dealing with that are out of the EU, so I've seen it a few places there. It has not been applied as broadly here in the U.S.
Okay, thanks. And we do have a few questions that came in about the data and the results. So in the chemical line of evidence slide, why do we have an increase in concentrations in 2010 compared to 2009?
Sure. So the remediation activities on the river, is considering it's a relatively small river, and there was active dredging from anywhere from 2 to 3 dredges at any one time on the river. We had an increase in concentrations associated with the suspended the water concentrations of, in this particular case, PCBs, but we saw something similar for PAHs. And that's largely because we have a disturbance in the system, and that's reflected in seeing these increases during this time.
Okay. And in the biological lines of evidence, one of our participants noted that the higher trophic fish species generally had the highest concentrations in 2011, 1 year after remediation. Can you explain that?
Yeah. Yes. I mean, we do see some response to those higher concentrations that were occurring in 2010 in the water associated and in some of the lower food web species. So if you look at emerald shiner, we saw an increase in that species in response to the concentrations in the water. So that response, that signal is being propagated up the food web, and we see that. Now, keeping in mind that, yes, we can see that there is a slight increase in the means, but if you looked at the error bars, we're largely seeing that these numbers are pretty consistent across these years following that dredging activity. The first time we see something statistically different really is this 2015 data value, for example, for largemouth bass.
Okay. And also, the dredge and non-dredge values both showed reductions. Is there a late relationship between the dredged areas and the non-dredged areas?
That
slide
about
there, yeah.
This one here, yeah.
For the macroinvertebrate, yeah.
I mean, they are in proximity to one another, so there is the potential, for sediment transport between some of these systems. It is important, and I did not mention it earlier. I could have from the previous map. Let me go back to a map real quick. This is still a lacustrine system, so the large majority, even up into sort of the middle of Reach 4 here, is impacted pretty dramatically by sesh conditions on the lake. So just downstream here, off to the far right here, the bottom of Reach 2, which is there, the arrow that I'm pointing at right now, is River Mile 3.2, and we're still seeing dramatic sesh effects, and we see even daily sort of sloshing effect in some of these systems. So we do have the potential that we are transporting material, both upstream and downstream, due to sort of natural flow conditions or flow reversals, as well as in the more dramatic sesh effects. So we're seeing some interaction between dredged and non-dredged as over time. We would expect, though, as we've lowered these as we've lowered these dredged area surface concentrations, that we would expect over time, as cleaner sediment moves into the system, that we would eventually see all of these declining over time.
All right. Well, thanks for that explanation. Mm-hmm. I think that's all of the questions we have from the participants. I don't have any further questions. I just want to remind folks that we do want to hear what some of your challenges are and what your research needs might be in the areas of long-term monitoring, especially in those areas that we've discussed today, that is statistical analysis of the data sets, passive sampling, toxicity testing, and using these various lines of evidence that Mark just described. So with that, I want to thank the speakers and turn the program back over to our technical moderator, Jean Ballin.
Well, thank you so very much, Jim. I'm going to walk through just a few quick reminders before we officially wrap up today's session. I'll again echo the reminders here that we have recorded the entire webinar series. So the first three in the series are already available for on-demand playback from the CLUIN archive page. We'll also send you an email when session number 4 is available for on-demand playback. We would encourage you to visit us on the Cleanup Information Network. Specifically, you might be interested in our contaminated sediment section. You'll find technology information along with a lot of other research and information about characterizing and cleaning up hazardous waste sites, including contaminated sediments, on that section. If you're interested in finding out about more online seminars, such as today's session, I'll encourage you to sign up for a free monthly newsletter, Tech Direct, which goes out on the first of each month. Now, again, there are copies of the presentation materials that were used today that are already available on the seminar resources or links page. You'll find that on the middle right of your screen under related URLs. You can click the seminar resources link and then press the browse to button to open it up. I've also included it in the Q&A window as a quick reference link. You can just click on that. If you happen to be replaying today's recorded version, you can still click those links and access the materials. Contact information for our presenters and organizers has also been posted there, and we do have an online feedback form for our session. So I will encourage each of you to fill out that online feedback form to provide not only your thoughts on the session today in terms of materials and how we delivered it, but also, as Jim was just highlighting, where research needs should be focused. So you'll see very specific questions on that feedback form where you can share input on that. Now, one of the most common requests I get as a session moderator is if there are participation certificates. And just like with the others in the series, we will issue a participation certificate, but only after you complete feedback for today's webinar. So follow the link to the seminar feedback form, fill it out completely, making sure your email address is in there correctly, and be sure to check the box at the bottom of the seminar indicating you were here for the whole thing. This also applies to those of you replaying the recorded version. You can still follow the link to the feedback form and submit feedback based off of your replay, but please make sure you check the box at the bottom of the form. If you do that, as soon as you submit the form on in, you'll immediately have access to a participation certificate like this that you can print out or save for your own records. Now, if you happen to participate in a group, each person can actually fill out that feedback form, even if you didn't register individually. So I would ask those of you that hosted the viewing in that particular conference room who did register, please be sure to copy that link to the feedback form and share it with those who joined at your location so they can get their own certificates for participating. And for those of you who are looking for CLPs, which is a particular type of credits, we do have almost all of the information you would need for the CLP request on the seminar homepage. The title, the description, information about when the event was hosted, how many points you can request, all of that can be found on the seminar homepage. But I would also encourage you not only to save your participation certificate, many people find that if they download the presentation materials or include their registration emails, along with that certificate for supporting documentation, they're able to get credit with their own accrediting institution. And so with those quick reminders, again, I will thank everybody who joined us for today's broadcast. We had well over 250 live participants for this fourth and final session, and I want to thank all of the presenters and organizers who took time out of their day to share their technical expertise, as well as our session facilitator, Jim Rice, who has been with us for this series. We hope that you found this to be a valuable expenditure of your time and that you'll join us for future webinars on CLUIN. This will be the formal conclusion for today's live broadcast. Thank you so very much for joining us.